Chapter 74. 3 weeks before Sean's wedding, Ada Courtney went into her orchard one morning early to pick fruit for breakfast. She found Mary there, dressed in her white nightgown and hanging by her neck from the big avocado pear tree. Ada cut her down and sent one of the servants to call Dr. Fraser. Between them they carried the dead girl to her cubicle and laid her on her bed. While Doc Fraser made a hasty examination, Ada stood staring down at the face that death had made more pitiful. "What depths of loneliness drove her to this?" she whispered, and Doc Fraser pulled the sheet over the corpse and looked across at Ada. "That wasn't the reason. In fact, it might have been better if she were a little more lonely." He pulled out his tobacco pouch and began to load his pipe. "Who was her boyfriend, Aunt Ada?" "She had none." "She must have." "Well, why do you say that?" "Aunt Ada, this girl was 4 months pregnant." It was a small funeral, just the Courtney family and Ada's girls. Mary was an orphan, and she had no other friends. 2 weeks before the wedding, Sean and Michael finished the season's cut of bark and switched the Zulus to planting out the blocks destroyed by the fire. Together they drew up a draft profit and loss account. Combining their rudimentary knowledge of accounting and arguing far into the night, they finally agreed that from 1,500 acres of wattle, they had cut 1,420 tons of bark to gross a little over £28,000 sterling. But here all agreement ended. Michael insisted that the stocks of material and expenditure on planting of new trees be carried forward, giving a net profit for the year of £9,000. Sean wanted to write all expenditure off against income and show a profit of £1,000. So they deadlocked and finally sent all the books to a qualified accountant in Pietermaritzburg. This gentleman sided with Michael. They then considered the prospects for the coming season and were a little awed when they realised that there would be 4,000 acres of wattle to reap and an expected gross of £80,000 sterling, always providing there were no more fires. That evening, without Sean's knowledge, Michael wrote two letters, one to a manufacturer of heavy machinery in Birmingham, whose name and address Michael had furtively copied from one of the huge boilers in the Natal Wattle Estate Company's plant, the other to the firm of Foyle's Booksellers in Charing Cross Road, London, requesting the immediate dispatch of all and any literature on the processing of wattle bark. Michael Courtney had caught from Sean the habit of dreaming extravagantly. He had also acquired the trick of setting out to make those dreams become reality. 3 days before the wedding, Ada and her young ladies set out for Pietermaritzburg by train, and Sean, Michael and Dirk followed in the rolls. The three of them arrived dusty and bad-tempered outside the White Horse Hotel. It had been a nerve-wracking journey. Sean had enlivened it by shouting incessant warnings, instruction and blasphemy at Michael, the driver. "Slow down, for God's sake, slow down. Do you want to kill us all? Look out, look out. Watch that cow. Don't drive so close to the edge." Dirk had done his share by demanding halts for urination, hanging over the sides, climbing tirelessly between the front and back seats, and urging Michael to exceed the speed limit set by Sean. Finally, in anger, Sean had Michael stop the car and administered corporal punishment with the birch of a melkboss tree cut from beside the road. On arrival, Dirk was met by Ada and led away snivelling. Michael took the rolls and disappeared in the direction of the Natal Wattle Company's plant, where he was to spend most of the following 3 days snooping and asking questions. And Sean went to find Jan Polis Leroux, who had come down from Pretoria in response to Sean's wedding invitation. By the day of the wedding, Michael Courtney had compiled a small volume of notes on wattle processing, and Jan Polis had given Sean a minute account of the aims and objects of the South African party. But in response to his urgings, Sean had promised only to think about it. The wedding ceremony had given everybody much cause for thought. Although Sean had no qualms about marrying in a synagogue, yet he steadfastly refused to undergo the painful little operation which would enable him to do so. His half-hearted suggestion that Ruth should convert to Christianity was met with a curt rejection. Finally, a compromise was agreed, and Ben Goldberg persuaded the local magistrate to perform a civil ceremony in the dining room of the Golds. Ben Goldberg gave the bride away, and Ma Goldberg wept a little. Ruth was magnificent in Ada's creation of green satin and seed pearls. Storm wore an exact miniature of Ruth's dress and sparked off a minor brawl with the other flower girls during the ceremony. Michael, as best man, conducted himself with aplomb. He quelled the riot among the flower girls, produced the wedding ring on cue, and prompted the groom when he muffed his lines. The reception on the lawns was attended by a huge crowd of the Goldbergs' friends and business associates, and by half the population of Ladyburg, including Ronnie Pye, Dennis Peterson, and their families. Garrick and Anna Courtney were not there, nor had they acknowledged the invitation. Brilliant sunshine blessed the day, and the lawns were smooth and green as expensive carpets. There were long trestle tables laden with the fruits of Ma Goldberg's kitchen and the products of Ben Goldberg's brewery. Storm Friedman went from group to group of guests, boosting up her skirts to display the pink ribbons in her pantaloons until Ruth caught her at it. Having found his first taste of champagne very much to his liking, Dirk went on to drink 6 glasses of it behind the rose bushes. He was then copiously ill. Fortunately, Michael found him before Sean did, and spirited him away to one of the guest bedrooms, and left him there to languish. With Ruth on his arm, Sean inspected the display of wedding gifts, and was impressed. He then circulated among the crowds on the lawn until he reached Jan Polis, and fell into an earnest political discussion. Ruth left them to it, and went to change into her going-away clothes. The prettiest and most blonde of Ada's young ladies caught the bouquet. Immediately thereafter, she caught Michael's eye and blushed to match the crimson carnations in her hand. Amid a hum of appreciative comment and a snowstorm of confetti, Ruth returned and, like a queen ascending the throne, took her seat in the rolls. Beside her, Sean, in dust coat and goggles, steeled himself, muttered his usual incantations, and gave the rolls its head. Like a wild horse, the machine seemed to rear on its hind wheels, and then tear down the driveway, scattering gravel and guests, Ruth clutching desperately at a large hatful of ostrich feathers, and Sean shouting at the rolls to, "Whoa, whoa, whoa there, girl, whoa!" They headed out along the road that led through the Valley of 1,000 Hills, to Durban and the sea, and disappeared in a tall column of dust.